This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
While the disappearance of a Malaysian airliner 6 weeks ago remained a mystery, with families of 239 people anguished by not knowing, there's a fresh tragedy in Asia. Now a South Korean ferry has capsized. Again, many passengers are missing. Details coming up. And we'll go to Boston. This year's marathon is this coming Monday, and it's only a year since the bomb explosions that killed three people. You'll hear CBS's Heather Bosch at memorial events this past Tuesday.
Church bells pealed as people gathered, raising a flag and holding a moment of silence at 2:49 p.m. Eastern, the exact moment 1 year ago that the first of two bombs ripped through the finish line.
And we'll go to a murder scene near Kansas City. CBS's Dean Reynolds will report three people shot dead, according to authorities, by a well-known racist.
Even before the police had arrived at the Jewish Community Center, before they had arrested the heavily armed shooting suspect nearby and bundled him away in a cruiser, a handful of people were on the scene and knew it was bad.
I am the daughter of a victim, and I am the mother of a victim.
You'll hear that woman so poised and poignant after her father and her son were murdered. Also, interviews with President Obama and Vice President Biden, and a lot more on this weekend roundup. But first, the South Korean ferry disaster. A large ship carrying passengers and vehicles overturned in strong currents. The ferry had 475 people on board, including high school students on a field trip. As of Friday night, 28 bodies had been recovered. Around 270 people were missing. Divers were having a very difficult time getting into the ship underwater. CBS News Asia correspondent Seth Doan reported on Friday morning.
Rescuers hammered on the hull of the capsized ferry, hoping for a response. None came. Divers tried to pump in oxygen to help anyone still alive below deck, but strong waves and heavy winds made it impossible. We made 5 to 8 attempts, this Coast Guard chief said, but in the end, we have failed to enter the sunken ship. One of the only bright spots was when a 6-year-old was plucked from the ferry. Her parents and brother remain missing. The 69-year-old captain faces a criminal investigation. He may have been among the first off the sinking ship. I am so sorry and ashamed, he said. I am at a loss for words. No one knows why the ferry sank. The state broadcaster said it was possible the cargo, about 1,000 tons, was not tied down properly. It may have shifted suddenly, causing the ship to tilt dangerously. But when the ferry started listing, some survivors say they were told to stay where they were. The evacuation order was not given for another 30 minutes, and many said they never heard it.
Seth Doan reporting from Incheon, South Korea, where relatives of the ferry passengers have gathered. Early in the week, Seth reported from Beijing, where Chinese families of people who were on the missing Malaysian airliner remain angry at Malaysia's government, claiming there's some kind of a cover-up. This while the pinging sounds stopped coming from under the Indian Ocean. Officials believe the batteries ran out on the black box recorders from the plane. Now a high-tech drone submarine is searching for debris.
Monday, search teams deployed the Bluefin 21, an unmanned underwater vehicle equipped with sonar. The submersible will paint a virtual picture of the ocean floor. Captain Mark Matthews is in charge of the U.S. Navy's salvage operation.
Our mission right now is to go look at the higher priority areas and to see if there's any debris there and just continue to keep hitting those small areas to see what we see on the bottom.
The Bluefin 21 is working in 24-hour cycles. It takes 2 hours to reach the ocean floor, 15,000 feet below the surface. The submersible will scan the seabed for 16 hours and draw up a picture of the environment looking for wreckage. Angus Houston is in charge.
It may be very difficult to find something, and you don't know how good any lead is until you get your eyes on the wreckage.
That from CBS's Seth Doan. As this weekend began, Australian authorities said still no physical evidence of an air crash had been found. Word came from the Obama administration on Friday that a decision on the Keystone XL oil pipeline, planned to go from Canada down south to a port in Louisiana, is again delayed. Federal agencies are being given more time to review the evidence for and against the pipeline, how many public comments have been received that have to be reviewed, 2.5 million. Republicans call this a shameful delay when America needs energy security. It looks like the controversial decision won't come until after the midterm elections this November. Now the crisis in Ukraine. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Geneva, Switzerland on Thursday, meeting with Russia's foreign minister and officials of other nations, including Ukraine. A deal was announced. CBS News State Department correspondent Margaret Brennan in Geneva.
The agreement requires all illegal armed groups to disarm and hand over seized buildings. In exchange, they'll be granted amnesty. All sides must refrain from violence, extremism, and anti-Semitism. International monitors will help Ukraine's government restore order. And the new Ukrainian government promised to allow greater autonomy to parts of the country, a gesture to the pro-Russian separatists.
And more explicitly, on Friday, Ukraine's leaders announced that Russian speakers will have new constitutional protections. At the White House, President Obama again demanded that Russia pull back its troops from the border with Ukraine.
Our strong preference would be for Mr. Putin to follow through on what is a glimmer of hope coming out of these Geneva talks, but we're not going to count on it until we see it.
We have more from CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick.
The agreement calls for pro-Russian groups in Ukraine's east to disarm, and Secretary of State John Kerry made it clear he expects Moscow to apply that pressure. If not,
and we don't see a movement in the right direction, then there will be additional sanctions, additional costs as a consequence.
And he indicated the Obama administration is running out of patience and may give the Russians only a few days.
There seems to be hardly any talk about forcing Russia to reverse its annexation of Crimea. What's now at stake? Parts of eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russia activists with guns wearing ski masks seized government buildings. CBS News correspondent Holly Williams reported on Monday and Tuesday from there.
Masked pro-Russian protesters stormed the police headquarters. Then, after occupying the station, they raised a Russian flag. We found them putting up barricades around the building. They told us they're expecting a fight with the Ukrainian government. They just don't know when it will happen.
Holly Williams reporting from eastern Ukraine. Up next, murder with anti-Jewish overtones near Kansas City.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
All it takes is one racist with a shotgun to shock this country. A man attacked innocent people at two Jewish facilities in a suburb of Kansas City. He killed a doctor and his grandson, and then killed a woman who was visiting an old age home. It happened on Sunday, the day before Jewish families sat down for their Passover Seder prayers and meals. More from CBS News national correspondent Dean Reynolds on the scene in Overland Park, Kansas.
Even before the police had arrived at the Jewish Community Center, before they had arrested the heavily armed shooting suspect nearby and bundled him away in a cruiser, a handful of people were on the scene and knew it was bad. One in particular.
And I am the daughter of a victim, and I am the mother of a victim.
Mindy Corporan told us she had driven to the center to hear her 14-year-old son, Reet, sing at a regional competition, and to join her father, William Corporan, a 69-year-old family doctor known to his 10 grandchildren as Popeye.
I kept pulling around, and as I got close enough, I saw my father's body lying there next to the truck. I knew as soon as I came upon my dad that he was in heaven.
Then she saw her son.
I could tell that he seemed out of it. I couldn't even tell that if I'd tried to speak to him, if he could have spoken. It was very quick and kind of blurry.
Reet was a terrific singer.
Oh, say, can you see?
An A student and one step away from an Eagle Scout. A third victim, 53-year-old Teresa Rose Lamano, was visiting her mother at a nearby Jewish retirement home. All three killed were Christians, though because of the suspect's anti-Semitic statements, police believe Jews may have been the intended targets. to Mindy and her brothers, Tony and Will, it's inexplicable.
It's just trying to make sense of it for our family.
Can you?
No.
Make sense of
no.
it?
No.
No.
No. There's no amount of gauze or bandages that's going to heal this. This is going to be an open wound for the rest of our lives.
As for the man now charged with murder and likely to face federal hate crime charges, which also could mean the death penalty, a man long known to police as a white supremacist. He's 73 years old. More from CBS News correspondent Bob Orr.
For nearly 40 years, the suspect, Fraser Glenn Miller, has pursued an agenda of intolerance and racism. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate groups, says Miller founded his own chapter of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1980s. As the self-proclaimed Grand Dragon, he later renamed his group the White Patriot Party and led rallies in military fatigues under the Confederate flag.
One God, one race, one nation, so help us God Almighty, white power!
Miller, who sometimes goes by Fraser Glenn Cross, has openly preached a message of white supremacy. This clip is from a 1985 television interview.
I think blacks in the United States and Jewish people are the most racist people on earth.
Miller, a frequent contributor to a neo-Nazi website, is no stranger to law enforcement. In 1987, Miller and four other Klansmen were arrested by the FBI for stockpiling illegal weapons. Miller spent 3 years in prison, getting out early in exchange for testifying against fellow white supremacists. He tried politics, running and repeatedly failing on a white power platform. In 2010, he ran for the U.S. Senate in Missouri and appeared on Howard Stern's radio program. Miller railed against Jewish American leaders.
They control the federal government. They control the mass media. They control the Federal Reserve Bank.
Miller's campaign went nowhere. He collected 7 votes out of the nearly 2 million cast.
CBS's Bob Orr. This past Wednesday, while President Obama was visiting the Pittsburgh area, talking mostly about a job training initiative, he sat down with CBS News chief White House correspondent Major Garrett. This was a day before the deal reached by the U.S., Russia, and other countries aimed at reducing tension in Ukraine. You'll hear President Obama was trying to step up pressure on Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
There's no excuse for not only Russian troops being massed along the borders of Ukraine, but also there's no excuse for the covert support and certainly the rhetorical support that you're seeing for these militias that are taking over government buildings and causing chaos.
So it sounds like you're saying Vladimir Putin is trying to provoke a civil war.
Well, what I'm saying is that the Russians generally have not been respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. And that's not simply my opinion, that's world opinion. The question now becomes whether or not this can be de-escalated and resolved in a way that gives Ukrainians a chance to make their own decisions about their own lives.
I know you've thought a lot about this, Mr. President. In your mind, is there a line, never mind the color, is there a line in Eastern Europe or Ukraine that Vladimir Putin must not cross?
Ukraine is a sovereign nation that has deep historical roots with Russia. None of us think that somehow Ukraine can ignore Russia, should be hostile towards Russia, but we also don't think that Ukraine should be a vassal state.
During that interview on Wednesday, Vice President Joe Biden joined the conversation, and the subject turned to U.S. politics. If Biden decides to run for president in 2016, will it affect his job? And does he count on Barack Obama's support?
There is nothing I would do differently. If I absolutely knew I wasn't going to run, or I absolutely knew I was, there's nothing I'd do differently over the next 7, 8, 10 months. We have a very important job to do. The president, his agenda is one I strongly believe in. And we have upcoming elections in 2014. If I decide to run, believe me, this will be the first guy I talk to. But that decision hadn't been made, for real. And there's plenty of time to make that. We have a lot of work to do between now and November.
Mr. President, how does this all filter through your daily life?
I couldn't say it better myself. I've got somebody who I think will go down as one of the finest vice presidents in history, and he has been a great partner in everything that I do. I suspect that there may be other potential candidates for 2016 who have been great friends and allies.
It sounds like what you're describing is whoever the candidate would be running for a third term of the Obama presidency or an extension of the Obama.
I don't want to necessarily jam them up. You know, we all are part of this relay race, whether we're vice presidents, presidents. The truth is that we build off of what folks have done previously.
The president did not, in the end, say whether or not he would endorse Vice President Biden or anyone else. He's keeping himself out of this race.
Major Garrett of CBS News interviewing President Obama and Vice President Biden. Of course, Hillary Clinton may run for president. The former First Lady, former Senator, former Secretary of State now says on Twitter her most exciting title yet is Grandmother-to-be. After this announcement by her daughter, Chelsea, who's been married for 4 years to Mark Mezvinsky, son of two former members of Congress, by the way.
Mark and I are very excited that we have our first child arriving later this year. And
Chelsea Clinton is 34 years old. Coming up, Boston, this weekend before the marathon, a year after the murderous bomb blasts.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabee.
The Pulitzer Prize, considered the top award in journalism, is going to the Washington Post and the U.S. edition of The Guardian for the news they broke about the National Security Agency and its surveillance programs, based on leaks from Edward Snowden, who used to work for the NSA. Now in Russia, he's considered by the U.S. government to be a fugitive from justice. Talking about the information Snowden gave and the news stories that emerged, Barton Gellman, who got some of the Snowden leaks, told CBS radio affiliate WTOP here in Washington.
I have had the very strong sense every day that I'm doing something important, that there are fundamental issues here about the way that people get to govern themselves, about whether we get to know what our government is doing to us.
Gellman returned to the Washington Post after leaving that newspaper to work on books, specifically to write about government surveillance after his contacts with Snowden.
This has been the most exhilarating and sometimes the most frightening reporting experience I've ever had. I am very much aware of my responsibility to protect materials from disclosure that shouldn't be disclosed. And so I've had to put in place all kinds of security, and I've spent a lot more time with lawyers than I ever had in my life.
A Pulitzer Prize is also being awarded to the Boston Globe for its multimedia coverage of the breaking news 1 year ago when two bombs went off near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three people, wounding more than 260. CBS News correspondents Jeff Glore and Heather Bosch reported on the first anniversary memorial events this past Tuesday.
The day began with a wreath-laying ceremony at the marathon's finish line. For the families of the four who were killed. The Richard family was there with their daughter Jane, who lost a leg that day.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies.
Later, the larger tribute at a city convention center. First responders, families of the injured, medical staff, and survivors gathered. Patrick Downs and his wife Jessica both lost legs.
We will always remember our guardian angels. I am so proud to be a Bostonian because I am so proud to be connected to all of you.
There was music, even laughter. Adrian Haslett-Davis is a dancer. She lost a foot.
No milestone is too small to celebrate. Even walking into a non-handicapped bathroom stall for the first time doing a happy dance.
I'm Heather Bosch in Boston. Church bells pealed as people gathered at the Boston Marathon finish line, raising a flag and holding a moment of silence at 2:49 p.m. Eastern, the exact moment 1 year ago that the first of two bombs ripped through the finish line. The ceremony followed a memorial service where Vice President Joe Biden summed up the feelings of many.
We are Boston. We are America. We respond, we endure, we overcome, and we own the finish line.
You may remember last year, 3 days after the twin bombings in downtown Boston, the two bombers allegedly killed a police officer at MIT and hijacked a car. The man who was held at gunpoint in his car for 90 minutes until he escaped has now told his story to CBS News national correspondent Chip Reed. He's asking that we name him only as Danny. He's an immigrant from China. He says the elder brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who would die in a police shootout that night, forced himself into Danny's new Mercedes SUV.
He asked me, do you know the Boston Marathon bombing? I said, yes, I know. He asked, do you know who did this? I no. He said, I did that.
What was your reaction then?
I couldn't believe it.
The man was Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He and his brother, Johar, took Danny on a terrifying 90-minute ride.
I think about family, friends, dreams. I thought I cannot die tonight.
Danny believed the brothers were going to kill him.
Should I put my life in the hands of the terrorist? Or should I put my life in the hands of my own self?
And you decided to put your life in the hands of yourself?
Yeah.
Tamerlan briefly tucked his gun into the pocket of his door while Johar was paying for gas. Danny silently counted to four, then made his move. He quickly unbuckled his seatbelt and was gone in a flash. He ran to this convenience store across the street and yelled to the cashier for help.
I begged him to call the 911, please.
You begged the man in there to call 911?
Yeah.
Carjacking occurred at Richie Shelf. The victim fled the car.
When the police arrived, Danny said they could track the Tsarnaevs with his car's satellite technology. It was the turning point in a three-day manhunt, leading to a shootout with police that left Tamerlan dead and Johar wounded and soon to be captured.
I don't feel like a hero because I was trying to save myself.
But whatever motivated him, Danny's quick thinking almost surely prevented more bloodshed and terror. Chip Reed, CBS News, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This year's Boston Marathon is this Monday. 36,000 runners have signed up. A million people are expected to watch along the 26-mile route to show solidarity and defiance in the spirit of Boston Strong. What happened to the stuffed animals, notes, and other things placed at the finish line after the murderous bombings last year? For a while, that part of Boylston Street was a shrine. CBS News correspondent Elaine Quijano.
Steps away from the Boston Marathon finish line at the city's public library, some of the thousands of items left behind at the makeshift memorial are on display. The exhibit honors those killed, Crystal Campbell, Lingzi Liu, MIT police officer Sean Collier, and 8-year-old Martin Richard. Massachusetts resident George Katchen came here today to reflect.
Tragedies really do bring people together. It helps one to focus. Where do you want to go with your life? I mean, I get into tears right now just even talking about it, thinking about it.
The objects from around the world convey gratitude to the first responders and sympathy for the victims, symbols of solidarity and a city's enduring strength. Elaine Quijano, CBS News, Boston.
Now the death of the Nobel Prize-winning writer from Colombia, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He died at his home in Mexico City at age 87. With more, CBS Evening News anchor Scott Pelley.
Through novels and short stories, Gabriel Garcia Marquez introduced readers to Latin America, which he described as a source of insatiable creativity, full of sorrow and beauty. His 1967 novel, 100 Years of Solitude, sold 50 million copies in more than 25 languages. Garcia Marquez pioneered the style known as magic realism, the blending of the plausible with the miraculous. He was an early supporter of Cuba's Fidel Castro, and politics forced him to leave his native Colombia in 1981. He spent the rest of his life in Mexico.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm at Dan Revive.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
The murder trial of Oscar Pistorius is now in recess until Monday, May 5th. Pistorius, the Olympic sprinter who ran on carbon fiber blades, his legs were amputated when he was a baby, is now charged with intentionally killing his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, who was a model. The cross-examination of Pistorius by a very tough prosecutor ended this past Tuesday. CBS News correspondent Deborah Pata was in court in Pretoria, South Africa.
Chief Prosecutor Kerry Nell once again focused on the moments immediately after the shooting when Oscar Pistorius found his bloodied girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, slumped in the bathroom. Nell could not understand why Pistorius, who said he was screaming earlier, was then suddenly quiet.
You shot 4 shots through that door whilst knowing that you were standing behind the door.
That's incorrect, my lady.
That you knew that she was talking to you.
That's incorrect, my lady.
She was locked into the bathroom and you armed yourself with the sole purpose of shooting and killing her.
Nell then spelt out the prosecution's case, telling the court that Pistorius shot his girlfriend after they had an argument.
Now you see her. Now it's the opportunity for you to scream, Reva, Reva, are you fine? Why would you not scream then?
My lady, I don't understand that question.
You've now seen that she's in there. It's the first time that you know that she's in the toilet, am I right?
That's correct.
Why did you not scream then?
I don't know what the purpose would be of screaming, my lady. I was overcome with sadness and I was crying.
After 5 days of savaging, Null abruptly ended his cross-examination. Pistorius' advocate Barry Rue redirected a few questions to him, asking him to read a Valentine's card in which Reva Steenkamp wrote, "Today is a good day to tell you I love you." She never got to give him that card. That is the day on which Pistorius killed her.
That trial, of course, in South Africa. Now to Colorado, a woman's been murdered while on the phone with 911. The killer is alleged to be her husband. CBS News correspondent Barry Peterson reports.
Police were dispatched to an upscale Denver neighborhood.
A report of a domestic violence in progress. Her husband has been smoking marijuana. He advised they do keep a handgun in the house, but it's not in anybody's possession.
44-year-old Christine Kirk had called 911. She said her husband, Richard, was hallucinating, wanted her to shoot him, and was scaring their 3 kids. About 13 minutes later, with police still not on the scene, the situation apparently took an ominous turn.
According to the notes, he grabbed the gun and she screamed and the line disconnected.
Technically, she's still on the line. We've got an open line with her.
By the time officers arrived, Christine Kirk was on the ground, a gunshot wound to her head.
We're going to need homicide.
Richard Kirk, 47, was arrested and now faces first-degree murder charges. According to court filings, he admitted to a police officer that he had killed his wife. Domestic violence advocates say the system failed Christine Kirk.
Survivors count on an immediate response, and so what's so heartbreaking about this story is that that immediate response didn't happen.
In November, the Denver Post reported it took officers 7.2 minutes on average to respond to critical incidents, more than a minute slower than the year before. As police investigate the circumstances of Kirk's death, they will also look at why it took officers about 15 minutes to arrive and how they handled her 911 call.
It's unfortunate that, you know, she did lose her life. We are, you know, looking at all the aspects of what led up to it.
That from CBS's Barry Peterson in Denver. In Lake Mary, Florida, near Orlando, a woman was mauled by a bear in her driveway last weekend with head, arms, and legs badly injured. State wildlife officers responded by killing 5 bears in that area, mostly because they showed no fear of humans. More from CBS News correspondent Peter King.
Florida Fish and Wildlife spokesman Greg Workman.
They displayed abnormal behavior and approached the area and did not leave when they seen us and did not leave when we tried to scare them off.
Lake Mary is just a few miles from the bear's natural habitat in the Wakaiva National Forest, and it's not all that unusual for bears to wander there looking for food.
This is prime bear country. You're looking at almost a third of the state's bear population in this corridor, approximately.
Tall fences line the roads near the forest to keep the bears in and off the roads, but some do get out and find their way to nearby towns, usually looking for food, sometimes frightened off by humans and often winding up in trees. People are encouraged to have bear-proof trash containers. Workman says one man tells him,
"The bears have never been able to penetrate it."
Wildlife officials say with screw lids and sturdy construction, bears generally give up after a little while and walk away. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
Now a scam that perhaps all families should be aware of. Grandparents get phone calls that seem to be from grandkids in trouble begging them to send money. And some do. CBS News correspondent Carter Evans was able to interview a scammer who's been caught.
31-year-old con man is awaiting sentencing in California for his role in what's known as the grandparent scam. He agreed to let us in on how he did it, but only if we wouldn't reveal his name. Part of an elaborate scheme run out of Canada, he would call senior citizens in the U.S., impersonating a grandchild in distress, begging for cash.
How many people would fall for this?
1 out of 50, maybe.
It's estimated senior citizens are robbed of roughly $3 billion a year in financial scams. Phone scams are often run outside the U.S., and con artists usually buy their victims' personal information online.
We target people over the age of 65 because they're more gullible, they're at home, they're more accessible. Once you get them emotionally involved, then they'll do anything for you, basically.
Doug Shadell is with AARP.
It doesn't really matter what your educational level is because it triggers something emotional that causes you to act.
It happened to this 81-year-old grandmother. She was home alone in California last September when her phone rang. The caller said he was her 29-year-old grandson, arrested for driving drunk in North Carolina.
There was a desperation and an urgency in his voice, partly because he said, "Love you."
Did it sound like him?
No, but he said he had a broken nose.
So she immediately sent almost $18,000 to a bank account in North Carolina, thinking it was going to a lawyer. But her grandson wasn't in jail and wasn't in North Carolina. Her money was gone.
You are blinded by emotion.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Ellen Lindsay prosecuted the scammer we spoke to.
And the effect on the victims is so great. It's not simply the loss of the money. They feel stupid, they feel gullible, and they have nightmares about it and anxiety and depression.
What drives a person like you when you know how much pain it's causing people?
I didn't know how much pain this was causing people. I thought people, you know, were making $100,000 a year and they would lose a couple thousand here and there.
Do you feel remorse?
Of course. Wouldn't you?
Of course, CBS's Carter Evans in California wouldn't do it in the first place. Coming up, a woman with a senior White House job and a book about women having confidence.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
If evidence is needed that Al-Qaeda is not dead, even though Osama bin Laden was killed by Navy SEALs 3 years ago, radical Islamist websites are showing a video of an outdoor meeting of Al-Qaeda activists in Yemen, making threats against the U.S. CBS News correspondent Bob Orr reports on that.
Intelligence officials say it's unusual, highly unusual, to see a large gathering of militants in an area that's been so frequently targeted by U.S. drone strikes. On the tape, we see the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a man named Nasser al-Waishi. He restates his vow to strike the United States. Now, because the tape celebrates a February prison break by Al-Qaeda fighters in Yemen, analysts believe this video was made relatively recently. It's also notable that the tape shows some Al-Qaeda fighters with their faces blurred out, an obvious attempt to conceal their identities. Of course, the worry now is that those operatives could be involved in some kind of future plotting.
That from CBS's Bob Orr. We hope you're having a great Easter weekend if you're celebrating the holiday. Good Friday was a highlight of Holy Week in Jerusalem, where Jesus suffered on the day of his crucifixion. CBS News correspondent Robert Berger on the scene.
I've joined the traditional Good Friday procession here on the Via Dolorosa, or Way of Sorrows, in Jerusalem's Old City. This group from the Philippines is singing hymns and reading from the Gospels as they visit the 14 stations of the cross, as Israeli troops armed with assault rifles look on. It's a big turnout again this year, thanks to a long lull in Israeli-Palestinian violence. And despite the tight security, the atmosphere is calm. The procession winds up at the ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the traditional site of the crucifixion. It is there on Easter Sunday that Christians from all over the world celebrate the resurrection. Robert Berger, CBS News, Jerusalem.
In this country, on Good Friday, a musical way to remember Jesus being crucified, playing the St. Louis Blues. At CBS Radio's KMOX in St. Louis, Fred Bottomer heard from the organizer of the Friday night service featuring local jazz musicians in a downtown cathedral.
It's called Good Friday Blues, and we did it last year, and it was amazingly powerful, and it's some really incredible blues music at the foot of the cross at Christ Church Cathedral.
Cathedral Dean Mike Kinman.
Good Friday is that place where everything is stripped bare, where it is just raw pain, and that's really also what the blues are. The blues is music that cuts to the heart of everything that we are as human beings.
Fred Bottomer, CBS News, St. Louis.
Now let's hear from one of President Obama's senior aides. She is resigning after working for him for 9 years when he was a senator, a candidate, and now president. Alyssa Mastromonaco, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, keeping Barack Obama's schedule, and she confirmed to CBS's Charlie Rose she controlled who got to see the president.
I'm the person that everyone comes to. I have the answer for everything. I think the reason people think I'm so powerful is because they don't know what I do. And that mystery, which I have kept for good reason over the years, really intrigues people.
Because it gives you power.
Exactly. I'm a very internal person. I don't do a lot of public speaking. But when I'm on the phone, I think I sound like the booming voice of Oz. Someone once said that I should stay behind the curtain if I wanted people to be scared of me.
Even the president likes to kid around about Mastromonaco's height.
He likes to call me short, just like a big brother. When we would travel sometimes, be on the road, and it's maybe, you know, maybe not everything's going great, we can always make him laugh when we say, let's talk about how short Alyssa is. Let's make some short clips. And then he always has to crack a smile.
From Senate office to presidential campaign to the White House, she is one of the last remaining members of the original team.
My judgment is good judgment for him. The two of us together, I think we understand each other, and I understand what he's trying to do and how to get there.
After 9 years of juggling elections, wars, national tragedies, and a president's schedule, she's now ready for some downtime.
Can you go into the president and you say, you know, this is a time?
It's time.
Did he try to talk you out of it?
Of course. Of course. I think that he knew that for me, to actually get to the point where I said, you know what, it's time, that he understood.
Is the most exciting time of your life behind you?
It might be, but that's okay. If you look at the things that have made everything so exciting, running off of adrenaline every day, that's exciting. The actual experiences, I met the Queen, I met the Pope, I was at Nelson Mandela's funeral. Yes. What is there left?
A rare interview with Alyssa Mastromonaco, who is quitting her White House job, but will stay connected with Barack Obama, she says. That interview by Charlie Rose. Also on CBS This Morning, Charlie, with Gayle King and Nora O'Donnell, interviewed Katty Kay about how women can become more self-assured. Katty Kay is a Washington-based anchor for the BBC. She's written a second book now with her friend Claire Shipman, an ABC correspondent who happens to be married to White House spokesman Jay Carney. The book's title is The Confidence Code.
Women seem to hold themselves back. As you said, we have more degrees than men, we're better educated than men, but at some point we have these wells of self-doubt. We don't seem to quite believe that we deserve to be at the very top. There's a study that's just come out of the UK that asked graduate students at a business school, what do you deserve to earn in 5 years' time? The men said, I'll be deserving to earn $80,000. The women said, I deserve to earn $64,000. That's a 20% difference in what we think our value is, and it's holding us back.
It's interesting you point out time and time again in the book that men and women have confidence issues differently, that men may have doubts, but they never dwell on it, as opposed to us, we just keep beating ourselves up. Why is that?
You know,
and give some examples of that. I thought that was fascinating.
One of the things I learned writing this book is that it's okay to be nervous.
Yeah.
All of us are nervous. You walk into, for women, I think we often walk into situations where it is predominantly men in an executive suite or in an interview situation. And it's okay to feel those nerves. The difference between men and women, I think, is that women often let those nerves stop them from taking the next step up. Mm-hmm. And men don't. They let the criticism roll off them.
Yeah.
Or the perceived slight roll off them. We're carrying it around with us for weeks and weeks, and we need to let it go.
And in terms of raising our girls,
very important. I think we need to start This idea that girls have to be good girls. You and I have spoken about this, Gail.
You said encourage them to be less good, encourage them to be a little bad. That was such a contradiction to me.
You know, girls are brought up always to be good, and they get rewarded for being good. And then, you know, to ask for that pay raise or to go for that promotion, you have to be prepared to rock the boat.
Kati Kay, co-author of The Confidence Code, The Science and Art of Self-Assurance. Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.